ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Lila Jeffries is a photographer with a difference. Rather than taking fashion shots of models, she photographs and videos birds in a studio setting. Some of the birds are shy, some are curious, and others dance and sing their way through the photo shoot. The results are stunning, giant-sized portraits of our incredible bird life. The photographs include husband and wife budgies lovingly staring into each other's eyes, owls peering right into the lens, and a wonderful long-legged brolga leaping into the air with great joy. The images capture the remarkable detail and individuality of the birds, and they have enchanted audiences at exhibitions around the world. Lila Jeffries, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, I was going through some of these incredible portraits with some of my colleagues in the newsroom, and of course we started deciding who looked like who as we go through. Do you hear some people at exhibitions saying, that looks like so-and-so?
All the time. It makes me laugh. I've had people name them as, you know, come in, I had that show all on cockatoos, and they said, oh, I can name every prime minister in Australia looking at every single one of these portraits. And then you'll have people that have, sometimes someone will say, oh, that one reminds me of my, you know, my grandmother, or, you know, there's always stories.
Why birds for you?
I would say that it probably is a connection to wildlife. And birds, to me, are the wildlife that we can encounter every day. You know, I live in the city. It's not much of an exposure to me to, you know, all sorts of great wildlife. But birds, fortunately, a lot have adapted to the cities. And so I guess I'm a huge nature lover. And so, you know, seeing them, it's where it kind of started. You start to notice that they're beautiful, they're incredible, their lives are extraordinary. And from there, it just sort of becomes a love affair, you know. You just start noticing them. And then once you notice them, you can't stop noticing them.
Why was it important for you to have these pictures at size so that birds look human size or bigger, and people in the exhibitions, they have to look these birds in the eye? Some of the birds, the size of these prints, they're bigger than people.
That's right. Yeah, I think scale's really important. The concept behind all of that was, people don't notice how extraordinary they are, probably because they are small and because they move and because they're darting around in foliage. And so if you photograph them in a way that they are, you know, I photograph with very plain backgrounds and the focus is completely just on the subject, just on them. And then with scale, you print them at human size. All of a sudden, you're forced to look at them as an equal. You know, I like saying, I don't photograph birds, I photograph beings. Mm. It's like we are a being in human form and they are a bird. And if you look at them just into their eyes, you realize, well, you know, there's a lot of, we share this planet with these amazing beings. And when you look at them at that size, you can't help but just realize how extraordinary they are. So I think the scale helps people to actually just physically see what they miss on a simple level. But then I hope with the engagement through the faces of the birds, you start to sort of really look into their eyes and really start to notice them. Like, I mean, they're supermodels as well. Like,
they're beautiful, aren't they?
They're so beautiful. I always say, you look at fashion and think, no fashion designer is going to come up with what birds, you know, come up with. They are just stunning. So there's all sorts of layers to being able to look at them at that big scale.
And the expressions as well. It's really interesting having a look at the expressions on the faces of these birds. I remember years ago a wildlife guide in Africa were out on safari, and he was saying that buffalo always look at you as if you owe them money. And once you see that, they do kind of glare at you like, hurry up and pay it back. And with some of these birds, they look quite wistful. Others look like they're deep in thought. They're amazing expressions.
There is so much expression. And different birds have different kinds of expressions. I mean, I love working particularly with cockatoos, because when you spend time with them, you realize they have all this movement in their faces, like they have crest feathers that go up. Mm. You know, they have all these different expressions that they pull when you're communicating with them, just like humans do. And so, yeah, if you capture that, a lot of parrots are the same. They'll have this ability to show you by looking at them, you know, what's going on with them. Then there are other birds which are maybe not so expressive, but it's more just that you capture them in a moment and you get something out of it. You know, there's some sort of expression that comes.
Do the birds ever look at themselves in on the back of the camera or on a monitor at all?
No, yeah, I've been asked that before. They have no interest. Like, what they're interested in is connecting with you. So there's often just an amazing curiosity, and you watch them watching you and you sort of talk to them, and they're sort of tilting their head, they're listening. It's like this beautiful moment of interspecies connection. So there's this communication that happens. But as far as it goes in terms of, you know, I get really excited if I have this portrait that I think, oh my goodness, this is beautiful. They're like, they don't care, you know. They're just like, you know, want to eat some seed or, you know, have some fruit, depending on what kind of bird they are. They're not really interested in what the end result is. They're just more interested in the experience.
And where do these birds come from? Because you've got them indoors in a studio. Where are
yes.
they from?
Yeah, so the way I've worked for, I mean, we've been doing this for 15 years, and predominantly most of the work was always travelling to wildlife rescue centres. So there'd be different wildlife carers, and they have birds in care, and because the birds are in care, they're used to people. So you've already got an ability to be able to work with them because then they're sort of already used to being fed, they're used to being looked after. And I essentially would just set up like a makeshift studio, and the birds are in that environment, they're comfortable, and I can work with them. And then when it started to get to working with species that are really hard to access, then it'd be organisations like Taronga Zoo, you know, where they're organisations that are really focused on conservation, like deeply focused on improving the lives of wildlife. And then there's this other centre I've worked with a lot called Feathered Friends Bird Sanctuary, run by these amazing guys that, again, just do so much work behind the scenes to kind of help injured birds that come into care. And so mostly it would be travelling to these different organisations and photographing these birds. And sometimes now when I'm working with particularly big birds, then it's about hiring a studio, and then the bird would have to come to the studio, and there's a whole process in that as well.
I saw you were doing some filming with this wonderful brolga, which I want to ask you about, and particularly as a tall, slightly uncoordinated woman, I was really cheering this brolga on as it was dancing. So it's called Miss Brolga, is that right?
Yeah.
She's beautiful.
She's gorgeous. She's amazing.
Is she taller than you almost?
I'm 1.58, you know, metres. I'm not that tall, but if she's standing next to me and then she puts her bill up in the air, she can reach my height. Like, she's, and her wingspan, you know, Brolga's wingspan's got up to 2.4 metres. So we're talking a big bird. She was extraordinary to work with, and I've worked with her twice. So once was photography and doing my stills, and I did a portrait of her, which was the most incredible experience, and having her leaping in a studio and dancing.
Do they naturally dance?
Yeah, that's what brolgas are known for. It was that shoot that made me, I was so in love with this watching her perform and watching her dance, that was the beginning of me going, we need to do film with her, like do a much bigger
capture
kind of
that movement.
Capture that movement. Mm. And then that was a collaboration with my friend Melvin J. Montalban. We created an artwork called Nest. I didn't operate the camera. The camera was operated by this amazing cinematographer called Chris Bryant. So I sort of take on more of an artist-director role in that instance. But for that particular one, it was just magical. I mean, brolgas, when they greet each other, they do a deep bow. So they do this incredible deep bow to each other, and then they start to do this courtship dance, and it's just leaping in the air, and it's so kind of, it's like a mix between ballet and beauty, and then sort of gangly. And
they are.
Yeah, so it's like a little bit of everything, and I think all of that just makes it just heart-achingly beautiful.
And how do you create the atmosphere that you're looking for in the studio? Do you need to keep it calm, or do you want the birds to kind of fire up if they are a bit gregarious? How do you manage that, Lila?
Yeah, it's a good question. So it is really, really important to set the energy in the room. Like that is number one, because you can't capture a beautiful portrait unless you know that the bird is really comfortable. And that sort of traditionally has always been to be really quiet. So it's about making sure that there is like no distractions. It is just you and the bird, and you are completely aware of their movements and they are aware of yours. And it's a very intentionally gentle experience. But then what happens is it depends on the bird, because if you work with a Broga, or I've worked with this red-tailed black cockatoo, they're like such characters. They love the attention so much that before you realize it, you're all like clapping and cheering. And it's sort of, they respond to the energy of that, you know. So it kind of really depends on the subject that you're working with.
I saw some of the behind the scenes footage of Miss Broga when you were getting ready to film her. Yeah. And she's just kind of wandering around sort of backstage getting ready to come out.
Yeah, that was, I mean, that is the fun stuff. Like the moments when I just go, I cannot believe I get to do this, you know, this is my life, is actually the moments when I'm just on set and the bird is just doing its thing on set, you know. It's like I might even be reviewing some images and the Broga will just be right next to me, you know, just doing her thing, kind of standing, looking around. They sort of become crew, you know, and it just normalizes it. It's so special.
How do they interact when, if humans are jumping and moving around, do they respond to that?
Yeah, well, she did particularly. So her story is an interesting one. She was rescued from the Northern Territory as a young chick. She ended up at Feather Friends Bird Sanctuary, and Ravi and Alex are these two guys particularly that have raised her since she was a chick. And so they see her as part of, like, her flock. So if they dance, if they jump, if they flap their arms, which is like flapping their wings, to her that is, oh, this is playtime, this is what we do. And she communicates back. And so for me, witnessing that, you know, is an amazing experience. Apart from sort of working with her, I get to sort of see this relationship that the bird has formed with other people. It's pretty cool.
There are a couple of portraits there too of budgies who are not looking at you, they are looking into each other's eyes, because often budgies are paired for life. What's it like watching that dynamic?
It's really fun. The budgie was interesting because I started 15 years ago, I started photographing budgerigars. That's where it actually started. And as I'd worked through the years, I realised that I wanted to try and photograph couples, because I knew certain species of birds mated for life, and I thought it would be really beautiful to try and capture that. And I just wasn't sure whether it would work. I didn't really know what would happen, but I got these budgerigars that were paired up, and you know, it was just, they didn't care about me. They were just so into each other that essentially I'm sort of just there photographing them, but they're basically instantly, you know, they're touching each other, they're leaning into each other, they're looking at each other, they're preening each other. Like, they're just having their moment. I was so ecstatic because it just meant that I was able to capture that beautiful bond that these birds can have. And, yeah, sometimes it's like, hi, I'm here. They just didn't even notice me.
Do they ever want to check out all the equipment that you're using and get a sense of the space as well?
Yeah, definitely. I worked with this palm cockatoo at Adelaide Zoo in South Australia. And I remember when I was even setting up where she was located, she could kind of just see, but she was sort of had her neck kind of creaked around the corner watching me and looking at all of my equipment. And when she came in, we had this branch for her. She just was very shy to begin with, because she was like, you know, there's lots of photography equipment around, and she was just watching it all and just, it is that process of getting used to that and noticing that this is something new, you know. But what would happen over time, and, you know, with her, like, I remember I would, you know, you bond over an almond or something, you give her a nut, and over time she warmed up. And then by the end of it, it was just so enriching for her, because these birds are so intelligent. Mm. So for them to kind of understand what is going on and then sort of start to enjoy a process is sort of really fun. And by the end of it, and this happened to me so many times, they don't want to leave. Like they're just having such a ball because they're getting so much direct attention and there's so much communication happening and it's kind of exciting, the environment for them. So, yeah, that can be good fun too.
Your very early days, Lily, you were growing up in PNG at the very beginning. What sort of role did nature play in your life when you were a really little kid?
I think that was probably partly why I do what I do. So, yeah, I was born in PNG and my mum and my dad were working there. And, look, my memory, because I was young, I was little, but my memory was just nature was everywhere. And my parents were big nature lovers, my dad particularly. So my childhood was completely free range and in nature. That's just kind of all I knew.
Which part of PNG were you in?
So I was born in Port Moresby, but we lived in Goroka. I just remember the green, remember the colours.
Achingly green, isn't it?
Yeah. Achingly green. That's a beautiful way to put it. And I remember the calls, you know, they talk about the bird life and I remember the sounds. But I also just remember like the quirkiness, you know, we were given an orphan possum that was called Albert that lived with us. And I just remember, you know, having this possum, carrying this possum around with me everywhere. So, you know, it was just that kind of life. It was pretty cool.
And what brought your family to PNG?
My dad was a teacher and my mum a librarian. She opened up the first library in PNG.
Why do you think nature was so important to your mum and dad when you look at it now?
So my dad was actually born in the Isle of Man and my mum was born in India. My dad met my mum in India and they moved to Perth. So there's sort of a lot of travel. But my dad in particular always had this incredible love of wildness. You know, in the Isle of Man, it's so cold and it's so blistery and it's so dramatic. And I think he loved that, you know. And then in Australia, in Western Australia, my granddad had bought this property in Southwest Australia and it was kind of our family bush block. And so, you know, we would go there camping every weekend. And then eventually my granddad had built like a shack that we would go stay at. And it was just an escape, I guess, from on the busyness of life, I suppose. You know, it was just my dad just seeked it out. You know, our family car was a combi and really I just remember always travelling around and always that any opportunity to get out of the city, and that's what, you know, my parents would do.
And in PNG, how much did you enjoy and explore the culture and the language of PNG as well?
There's lots of funny stories about that because, you know, there's the Pidgin English in PNG.
Which is wonderful.
Which is so wonderful, so wonderful. And the one that I always remember that I love was the word for helicopter, which was Mixmaster Jesus Christ.
Which is perfect, isn't it?
It just describes it so wonderfully. That was pretty special.
Your family moved back to Perth when you were five. Do you remember what it was like coming back to Perth after this incredible early few years in PNG?
I do remember school and I remember just being a little bit of a bit scared of humans, to be honest. Like I remember being really comfortable and happy around animals, like animal obsessed. And so suddenly, yeah, being in Perth and then having to go to school, I just remember feeling pretty anxious about that all. It wasn't, yeah, I just remember not knowing. In a way, it was almost like, I don't know how to be people. I don't know how I'm meant to be, you know.
That's a really interesting way to put it.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? It took me a long time to work that one out too. I don't know if I'm still working out.
Now, your parents then, when you were 13, decided that you were all going to go to India as a family. What was the thinking behind that? What's your understanding of why they made that decision?
Well, it was because my dad was actually younger. I thought it was older, but I was actually younger. I was more like 10 when that happened. And my dad had long service leave. So there was this move. Both my mum and my dad had a connection to Nasrapur in India, which is just near Pune, just outside of Mumbai. And my dad was a big lover of language. So that was a huge thing for him. So they had decided that they wanted, you know, to, I guess, also for my brother and me to have the experience of living in a different place, and they were adventurous. So we went and spent some time in Nasrapur, which was, I've always thought of it as probably one of the most magic times of my life, to be honest. It was a particular time when I just remember being so happy, like really free-range kid happy, where I was just in an area that was basically like a jungle and sort of free to just explore. It was one of the most glorious times.
What do you think of the risk-taking that Mum and Dad were prepared to give you at that time?
I think it was probably one of the best things that I've ever had in my life. You know, there is something in the saying of take care, take risks. Mm. I think that it is so healthy for us to take chances, to take risks, to do things that might be seen as risky, because the reward comes from those experiences. If you play everything too safe and you don't sort of broaden your horizons and get to have some wild experiences, you miss out on so much of life. Mm. So something about that has always stayed with me. I have a 14-year-old son now, and I noticed that I don't have any real anxiety about him going out and exploring. Like, it's just this, my dad and my mum managed to pass down to me just that real comfort in letting people explore.
Tell me about the teacher that you had with you in India.
Oh, so her name was Barbara Lister, and she was actually my dad's mother's friend, and she was coincidentally from the Isle of Man as well and was living in Perth. And she was a teacher but had retired. She actually taught my dad and my uncle how to drive. So she was sort of a family friend. And anyway, she had retired, and my dad had put to her if she would like to come with the family to India to teach my brother and me while we were going to be away. And we had this house, and downstairs was this room that was like this makeshift room that we turned into a classroom. And during school hours, she was Mrs. Lister. You know, that's you know, you call your teacher. But after 3 o'clock, she was Aunty B. So she, again, is somebody that has stayed with me in my life, who really had a profound effect on kind of the choices that I made later on, because I think she spotted from a very early age, she could tell in me that I was a bit of a nature lover and an animal lover, and she could see that I love drawing, I love being in nature. And so during that schooling time, the way she taught us, so much of it was just hands-on learning. You know, she got, I just always remember her teaching us how irrigation works, and we did this in the mud, you know, we made it. And then I got totally devastated when these buffaloes came and just stampeded over and destroyed it. But, you know, it was just that ability. She would take us to the river, and I remember watching kingfishers, you know, fishing, and just knowing somebody that saw you, you know, when you're little and you...
Someone gets you.
That was her, and she was just unbelievably kind. So kindness beyond, and then ability to see you, and yet also a phenomenal teacher, you know. She cared about making sure that I learnt what I needed to learn. She was great.
It's pretty amazing that she said yes to that.
I know. She's so cool. Do you know that she is 104? She's still alive. She lives in Albany, and she's 104 years old now.
Wow.
Yeah.
What do you think is the most important thing that she taught you?
I think it was a feeling of, you work out what you're drawn to, and that's what you cultivate. So, you know, it's just like identifying what are your strengths, what are your interests, as opposed to sort of a teacher trying to put you into a box and shape you. It was more about allowing me to be who I was and knowing that that's okay.
How much generosity do you think there is in that kind of teaching, not ramming information and views, but letting a kid kind of be themselves?
Absolutely. In fact, it goes so far as, even with the art that I create, I think about how I know what I want to convey, but I want people to experience it the way they experience it and walk away with their own interpretations, their own meaning. It's so important in life that people are sort of not judged or told what to do, but just sort of unconditionally accepted and just encouraged. Does that make sense?
It does.
podcast. Broadcast. This is Conversations with Sally Sara.
Lily, we're talking about your childhood and time that you had in India. What did the village kids make of you and your family?
I thought they thought we were probably pretty crazy. I don't know. I mean, I just remember people kind of always staring at us and probably thinking we were a little bit strange.
Your family then went to Kashmir to spend some time on a houseboat there. What was that like for you?
It was amazing. So that was the first time that I saw snow. And so even that was a, you know, incredible experience. And it was the houseboat, oh, they were just so beautiful. So these houseboats are just on this still lake. And Kashmir is just stunning. We're talking mountainous ranges. Mm. So you're just surrounded by so much nature, and you're on a houseboat, you're in nature. And the houseboats are sort of connected, like you would go, I don't know how to explain it, but sort of the top of it, I remember running across it, and then you would jump down onto a ramp, and then there's all these little places that you could go and explore. And my brother and I just had so much fun playing there. I remember it was like the best playground you could ever imagine. It was, yeah, really stunning.
What sounds would you hear first thing in the morning in Kashmir on the lake?
The kites. The kites make a particular call. I remember them like vividly. They were everywhere. But then also, how do you describe that? It's almost like an essence of peacefulness. It's a hard thing to explain, but it had a kind of like a place where time forgot. Like it had that sort of sense to it. So it wasn't like you would hear any human noises, you know, it was very much just a nature experience.
Was there a wish from your mum for you to connect with some of her culture?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, I think both my parents really encouraged us. I mean, my auntie and uncle were in Mumbai and my cousins were there. And actually through the years, they always made sure that I would go, you know, that I would, Bruce and myself would go to India and have a real close connection. Ajim, my grandmother's name is Leela, so I was named after her.
What were your observations of India growing at that time? Because the economy was starting to fire up, and it sounds like you were really immersed in nature, but industry in India was really starting to wake up, and pollution and all those consequences.
Yeah, definitely. My memory of India really was just the chaos of it. It was the noise and the chaos. And for me, that was actually kind of adventurous and quite exciting. You know, I remember the trains. I remember what it was like running in, getting pushed into these trains and being shoved up against bodies and, you know, always making sure that you hadn't forgotten something or forgotten somebody, like rush, rush, rush. And the noise and the traffic, like this is in Mumbai because Mumbai is a big city.
It's massive.
It's massive. And just like the movement of the traffic, like the, you could not makes sense of how there is not car accidents, you know, like there is so much chaos going on. And I'd say something that was so cool about India, and I always think about this in life, is like this, you always want this balance between structure and chaos. Like too much structure is not good for us, too much chaos isn't good for us, but you know, a balance between the two. And in India there is just this chaos, but within it some kind of structure that just works, you know, I don't know how. And yeah, it just was a pretty exciting place to be.
You come back to Australia to high school after this incredible adventure in India and Kashmir. What does that feel like?
Not loving school. I wasn't a huge fan of school. I think it was just simply that I was always just felt like I didn't really know what I was meant to be doing at the time, to be honest. So school, you know, we talk about structure and chaos, and I think I was really comfortable in the chaos. I was comfortable in the wildness, and I wasn't really schooled in the structure of day-to-day school. So it took me, you know, a while to kind of work my way through all that.
After school and after uni, you start getting the first ideas about photography. Why photography, do you think?
I remember always thinking, what is it that I want to do? Like, I didn't know. I really tried really hard to work that out. But the only thing that was a constant was that, well, my dad, to begin with, did love photography and would take beautiful photos of us when we were away. So, you know, I would see my dad with the camera. But then I studied it. I was lucky in high school. They had a photography class. And so I studied it in high school and I loved my teacher there. And then I did a cross-enrolment at uni and I'd studied it at uni. And it was just the one thing that stayed with me. It just kept being this one thing. And so I thought, you know, I probably should study it properly and, you know, go off and be a freelance photographer. And that's the job I need to have.
We have to do photography sometimes for work in journalism. And I always find I lose track of time. I get my eye on that camera and I really lose track of what's going on because I'm so absorbed in what I'm seeing. Is it like that for you sometimes?
Oh, yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. It's great. I mean, photography to me is a lovely way to kind of close off the exterior world, you know, and I actually sort of see it. I think everyone has different tools and I think in life we're all just trying to kind of cultivate self-awareness through whatever we do. And, you know, you could be a painter and you're painting or photography or you could be a writer, but essentially photography for me is just this moment where the mind kind of quietens and you just get completely immersed in something, and that process is wonderful, is really special.
When did you get the first ideas that it was birds that you wanted to photograph? It's quite an unorthodox choice at the beginning.
It is, yeah, definitely. And it wasn't, you know, when I studied photography, I thought I was going to be a freelance photographer, I was going to photograph people. I tried doing that and I just didn't like it at all.
Why?
Oh my goodness, it was just didn't suit my constitution. I realised, firstly, when you're photographing people, I think I became quite self-conscious about, you know, about that whole process. And then secondly, you have to work so fast and then you have to turn them around and you have to give them the photo and everything about it just didn't feel right. I couldn't do it. I didn't like it at all. But I had become a backyard bird watcher. You know, I'd just become, you know, that was my sort of, you know, realizing that I was missing nature. And then I was actually bird watching on Christmas Island. I'd been doing some volunteer work also with some ornithologists tagging seabirds. And I was with these, you know, wonderful bird watchers and we all had our binoculars and we were all looking at these incredible birds. And I remember thinking, why is it that people don't get how cool they are? You know, what is missing? And that was this little light bulb moment where I just went, oh, it's, you know, it's because they're small. It's because they move. It's because, you know, they, people just don't even look up. And that's when I started thinking, wouldn't it be beautiful if I took a portrait of a bird in the way that was a traditional portrait style? And it sort of started with that idea, but not for anyone to see. You know, originally it was actually just, it's something that I wanted to do for myself. I hadn't really thought anything past that point. But it was definitely something that came to me that I could not drop. Like I became obsessive about it.
Why film them in the studio rather than out in the wild and then just blow those pictures up to a larger size?
I guess, well, a few reasons. With when you work in a studio, you can control your lighting. And one of my previous jobs, I'd been a photo editor working in magazines, and I had spent just years looking at beautiful photography. You know, I was able to see what studio photography can bring when you light a subject wonderfully and you spend time with the subject. And so I realized I'm not a wildlife photographer. It wasn't where I wanted to go. I was much more interested in a kind of art sort of base focus, I suppose. And so with the studio, instantly you're cultivating. First, you're creating the space where there is no distractions. You know, you have a very simple backdrop and you just have a subject, and instead of a chair, you have a perch. But, you know, it's all very simple. But then you're just cultivating an ability to spend time with a subject, a period of time where you can then start to see how that evolves and how that goes. Whereas if you're a wildlife photographer, you're sort of trying to capture a moment that will disappear.
It is what it is.
It is what it is. Mm. But in a studio, it's a little bit more of a communication style. It's a little bit more of a connection, and then let's see what comes of it.
Now, we hear the expression budgie smugglers sometimes in reference to swimwear, but you actually smuggled some budgies into a studio for ACP, Consolidated Press. Is that right? What happened there?
So funny. That was the very beginning. I was absolutely obsessed with this idea of doing this kind of portraiture with these budgies. And I was working in ACP at the time. I was a photo editor, and I was friends with one of the photographers in the studio there, and I didn't really have the technical skills with the lighting, and so I asked him if he would help me, you know, do this shoot, and we organised it on a weekend. But of course, you know, there's all sorts of rules, and I was like, how the hell am I going to get these birds in? So I had to kind of sneak them into the studio, going past the security guards, and, you know, budgie guards don't stop talking.
They're noisy.
So I was like, shut up. But anyway, I did manage to get them in there, and then that was when I sort of started doing what I do.
Lila, tell me about a budgie named Jimmy, one of the first that you photographed.
So Jimmy is where it really all started, and he's actually named after my husband, James. he was such a great bird. So just to go back a step, I basically became friends with a lovely man called Warren Wilson, who was the president of the Budgiegar Society of New South Wales. And through him, I sort of kept talking to him about, you know, could I have some budgiegars that I could work with? And I had this beautiful budgiegar, and he wasn't named, which is why I called him Jimmy. But he was the first bird I worked with doing what I do now, and it just blew my mind, his stance, his posture was just so at ease but proud. And, you know, budgiegars are tiny, but when you photograph them and you're looking at this tiny statue of a bird, but then you see that at a full size, they are like, I don't know how to explain it. They have so much character. It's unbelievable. And it was the most exciting experience for me. And I actually remember thinking it was the first time in my entire life, I'd taken thousands of photos, but it was the first time in my entire life I took something that was as good as my imagination. You know, I'd captured something that I realized, this is it. There's something here. And it was that particular bird. He was just so beautiful. He was so much fun to work with. So it kind of all started with him.
This was originally going to be just for you, but what sort of reaction did you start getting from people when you were starting to show people these big pictures of birds, these portraits?
Yeah, it caught me a little bit by surprise. I had a friend that was working for the Centre of Photography in Melbourne, and I sent her some of the photos that I'd taken, and she said, oh, look, can I, you know, send this to some galleries and see, just in case someone might be interested. But it was almost instant. Like, people would just, as soon as people see it, I feel like I must have tapped into the Australian psyche, because we kind of, if you start talking to people, people seem to all have a budgiegar story. And so I guess I didn't realise that I'd hit something. I remember this gallery contacted me, and they would put one work into an exhibition, like a group show with other artists, and it just sells straight away. And so then they do another, and it sell, and it sell. And so then they gave me a solo show, and we had all these cards printed up. This was on Oxford Street. And, you know, the cards would go for the invitation for this particular show in the front. And every day the gallerist would turn up and they'd all be gone. So it was just this thing that just, I didn't have a clue what had happened, but I just struck on something. And it just ended up in magazines and getting kind of a lot of coverage. And so it just took off from there straight away.
You put a series together called Prey, with Birds of Prey. How different was it working with those birds compared to budgerigars or pigeons or doves, working with owls and other birds? What was that like for you?
That was great. Every time you work with a different species group, you learn something new. And because the birds of prey are the top, you know, of the pecking order, really, essentially, they are instantly kind of comfortable. They have so much confidence in them that you sort of are a little bit like they can totally give you the stare. They can give you a good hard cold stare, and so they have that sort of just this gravitas about them. You know, they are so powerful. Really, I can't think of how other way to explain them. I worked out of an amazing rescue centre called Eagles Heritage in Western Australia, and I remember photographing this particular owl. And I do remember going, you can't take a bad photo of an owl. Like, they just, everything she did was just so beautiful. Yeah.
They're amazing, incredible looking birds. Which are your favourites, do you think?
Oh, it's so hard to say. I guess because I work with so, it's honestly, it genuinely is very hard to say. I mean, I've worked with this satin bowerbird that has stayed with me for a long time because it was such an incredible bird. But then at the moment I'm working with seabirds, and, you know, part of me hates to sort of say it because it feels so obvious, but penguins are hilarious. They're really fun to work with. I've worked with puffins out of a puffin rescue centre, and they were incredible. I mean, I guess I probably go back to cockatoos a lot because growing up in Western Australia, the forest red-tailed black cockatoos and the Carnabies and the Bordens were kind of the soundtrack to my youth. And so I'd say they are a subject that I always love, love, love working with because they are just social birds that want to connect with you, and they're just, every experience with them is always a pure joy.
What do you think about the fact that, you know, you've got this portrait style, almost like a human style, you're having these printed at large scale so that people have to look these creatures in the eye? Why can't we respect or engage with creatures automatically if they are smaller, if they're not at our eye level? Why do we need to do that, do you think?
Yeah, I've got a bit of a theory about that. I think what's happened to us, we're animals after all. We forget that we're animals. So I think through all the years of working with birds, I've started to realise it's almost like it's given me a great self-reflection on the human condition. And I would say what's happened with humans is we've just gotten so in our heads, and we've lost that moment of presence. And so when you're in your heads and in your thoughts and you're obsessively thinking, you're missing magic that's just happening around you all the time. You know, it's the stuff that we all hear about. It's mindfulness and meditation, and this is a bit of a joke, but I do think about it. It's like people worry about AI and they sort of go, you know, AI is going to be running the show. And I sort of think, you know, I reckon our minds are a little bit like AI. It's like they're running the whole system. We get sort of so caught up in doing and thinking and solving and in that kind of mindset, we forget what it's like when we were just present as a human, as a species, in a moment and experiencing in a moment. And so I noticed that people that are kind of really connected to nature and give themselves those breaks from, you know, from constantly thinking and doing, they're the ones that tend to see the beauty in the everyday, and they're the ones that notice it. So if you give yourself that opportunity to stop and look at nature, it's almost like nature is a door of bringing us out of that mindset and getting us back to remembering that we're animals and that we're all connected, that we're all part of this wonderful planet.
What do you think the biggest gift is that your mum and dad gave you with the experiences that you had as a kid, when you look back on it now, Leela?
I would say that freedom to explore, absolutely no, that they never kind of made me do something that, you know, forced me into a particular career or forced me into a particular interest. They just kind of allowed me to just play, and then of course just an exposure to so much wildness, of course, that has always stayed with me. I really think that what happens in your childhood plays out so much later on in your life, so probably that gift of that exposure, and then also just the freedom to be myself and be interested in whatever I was interested in, to encourage it.
your wonderful teacher in India, Barbara Lister, who's now more than 100 years old, how treasured is she to you still and a real reference point for you by the sounds of it?
All the time, so much. Yeah, I think about her all the time. I just, it's funny how you have people in your life that, you know, they're pivotal parts of your life.
You can set the compass off people like that almost.
Exactly, yeah, and that's her.
How do you think about the way that people and birds are interacting now as our environment becomes more intense? For all the technology that we have, if a magpie wants to swoop us on our way home, they'll come for us, right?
Oh, absolutely. And of course, I totally understand. That's not a fun experience, you know. But I like to, you like to go back and think, okay, well, we need to cohabit together. And this only happens during the nesting period. And for most Australians, they would have a pretty funny story, a pretty funny anecdote that might have happened from that. It's just kind of cool. It's kind of part of being Australian. In fact, it doesn't really happen in other countries. It's a very unique Australian thing to have magpies swooping you.
What do you think birds have taught you, all those hours that you've spent with them in the studio and in nature?
I guess so much. They've taught me about presence. They've taught me how to, it's almost like how to communicate on other non-verbal ways, you know, that, and I even think humans do this. We just don't even notice it, but they make you tap into just a way of seeing the world. How do you explain it? It's like, how do you see the world in the present moment as it's happening and you get out of your head? I guess, I mean, I've talked about that already, but that is kind of a really big part of what I've learned from them. And then that there is so many different ways that we communicate that are nonverbal, which again, I get with the birds. But then just on a really simple note, it's really more just, they are kind of like the symbolism to me of nature. You know, they're the symbolism that we're part of this whole interconnected, crazy, amazing planet, and that is extraordinary, and that you've got to treasure that.
Young you tearing around out the backyard and in the jungle in PNG with no shoes on, immersed in nature, what would little you think of what you've gone on to do, do you think?
Oh, I suppose just be really happy that there is a way to kind of make a living doing something that you love, you know, that you can, yeah, that you can find your thing, that we're all, it's almost like we're all born with our own unique gifts, and we if you just follow that thread, you find it.
Lila, it's been wonderful to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This conversation today was produced by Nicola Harrison. Our executive producer is Carmel Rooney. Conversations is made on the lands of the Gadigal, Turrbal and Jagera peoples. I'm Sally Sara. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.